All right, we were in Psalm 33. Before I get there, two things. Re-announce, Thursday nights will be in my office, the suites at 121 West Hickory Street. It's right next to the Loophole Restaurant. We'll meet going through the book called Men of Courage. It's one of the authors is Larry Crabb. You can get it on Kindle for $4, or you tell me, and I will order it for you if you like a hard copy. But we'll meet this Thursday at 7 o'clock. Also be thinking and praying about Robert Wagner, our assistant pastor, that their house would sell and they would be able to find a house here so that they would move, be able to move here quickly. All right, Psalm 33. If you had turned to the Psalms earlier when Jim was reading, then find the 33rd Psalm. If not, you can go to your table of contents and look under Psalms. Remember, the P is silent. And so here we go. Shout for joy in the Lord, O you righteous. Praise befits the upright. Give thanks to the Lord with the lyre. Make melody to him with the harp of 10 strings. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. For the word of the Lord is upright, and all his work is done in faithfulness. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. The plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen as his heritage. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of men, or children of man. From where he sits enthroned, he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. The king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might it cannot rescue. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. May his word live in us. Let me pray for us. Father, as we look at your word, that you would overwhelm us with your nature and your character of steadfast love. In your son's name, amen. Psalm 33 is in some respects, some aspects, a continuation of Psalm 32. And so Psalm 32 ends up with being, "Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, O righteous, and shout for joy, all you upright in heart." And it's a psalm of deliverance. And so Psalm 33 is received, if you're hearing it as a worshiper, and practiced, and it's oftentimes, it's initially relative to the worshiper. So, for instance, you may approach Psalm 33 from a posture of fresh deliverance. I've just been delivered out of anguish or depression or a bad situation in my life. And so you'll receive it and appropriate it that way. Or maybe you're in the throes of unconfessed sin, like I talked about in Psalm 32. Your bones are aching from all of this. Or maybe you're afraid. Or maybe you're tired. Or maybe you're approaching Psalm 33 confident in your righteousness, both in a positive sense, like I actually dig following the Lord, or in a negative sense, I dig it and I really don't need him, type thing. Regardless, you've got these commands at the very first part that say this: shout for joy, give thanks, make melody, play skillfully, and sing a new song. All right, these are commands that I find rather difficult to follow. So think of it this way. There's this movie that just came out. You don't have to watch the movie. You can just watch the trailer. But I've really enjoyed it because I'm sick that way. But it's called Whiplash. And it's a story of this jazz conductor and this student who's playing the drums. And in the trailers, if you watch the trailers, you hear the conductor trying to get the new drummer to play some song. And he keeps saying, not my tempo, not my tempo. And then he starts yelling at him. And then he starts slapping him. And then he's throwing chairs at him. And he's saying, were you fast or you slow? Was your tempo fast or you slow? He goes, I don't know. He goes, count off for me. 1, 2, 3. And when he gets to 4, then he smacks him. And he's, do it again. 1, 2, 3, back. 1, 2, 3, back. He's like, what? Fast or slow? Fast or slow? Fast. Fast. You know, I was playing fast, right? He's commanding him to do something. I need you to play skillfully. I need you to make a joyful noise. But all the while, I'm going to humiliate you. Now, the commands in Psalm 33 are no less demanding. But the source of strength, unlike the movie Whiplash, is not in the drummer's skill or the conductor's anger and fear tactics and unforgiving standard. The source is the steadfast love of God. And so if you want like an overarching point, the commands of the Lord are given in the context of the overwhelming steadfast love of the Lord. And so we're going to look briefly at 6 things. 1, the commands of the Lord. 2, the character of the Lord. 3, the actions of the Lord. 4, false hopes. 5, the protection of the Lord. And 6, the prayer of his people, the people of the Lord. So let's look at the commands first there in verses 1 through 3. Shout for joy, give thanks, make melody, sing to him a new song, play skillfully, let all the earth, that's in verse 8, sorry, I threw in verse 8 too. Let all the earth fear the Lord and stand in awe of him. Now, you need to know that these commands, they're not implied. It's not like, if you feel like it, this is what you should do. These are actually commands. And it's not predicated upon your worth. I want you to shout for joy if you're worthy. I want you to play skillfully if you're able. I want you to sing a new song if your circumstances warrant it. These commands have one goal in mind. Obey. I want you to obey, and they have one motivation in mind. The character of God. It isn't because right on the heels of it, sing to him a new song, play skillfully on the strings with a loud shout for the word of the Lord. And then it goes into what talking about who God is. It doesn't say for this is what you're supposed to be doing in life. For you're a really good person. This is what Christians look like. If you don't do it, something bad's going to happen to you. The motivation is always going to be God's character. Now I want to take one of those commands and think about it for a second. It says, sing to him a new song. Now, some people want to place end times significance on this term, new song, because you find it in various apocalyptic prophecies. But I think it's in response to our propensity to sing the same old songs. Because what we do is we sing the same old songs of failure. And we sing the same old songs of fear. And we sing the same old songs of unbelief and rebellion and pride and anxiety. And so when we enter worship and prayer, dragging our feet, scatterbrained, preoccupied, condemned, superstitious, hurried, resentful, accusatory, numb, prideful, and God is commanding a new song, he says, I don't care how you come. If you're coming anxious, prideful, numb, it doesn't matter to me. I don't want to hear your old song anymore. I want a new song. And the new song has to be one of joy and thanks. And I want it to be melodious. And I want it to be skillful. And there needs to be a little bit of reverence and awe involved in it. We've started tracking the songs that we sing in church, so we don't over-sing certain ones, right? We want to know how often, and we might adding a category of, are we singing a lot of songs about justification? Are we singing a lot of songs about sanctification? Are we singing no songs about resurrection? Do we only do that at Easter? Are we only singing songs about the incarnation at Christmas? You know, all of these different things. What I would ask you is, what is your playlist? What's your songs that you sing to God? And might it need freshening up? Because what happens is you approach God in a posture oftentimes of all these different things that I've listed. Fear, anxiety, doubt, unbelief. And your song to God is one of anger or one of woe is me or one of I don't even know if I believe this stuff anymore. And what God is actually commanding everybody, believer and unbeliever alike, I need you to sing a new song. And here, and I'm going to give you the content of the song. Here it is: joy and melody and skill. And I'll give you some more content in my character. So that's what our second thing is. He goes, look, if you need a source for your new song, look at verses 4 through 12. The commands are followed by this word, for. I want you to do this, and here's my reasoning. Our content for our new song and our motivation are to be found in God's character. So the first thing he says is, for the word of the Lord is upright. That's the very first part of verse 4. Jump down to verse 6. This kind of explains why his word is upright. It says, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host. Because if you need some source material for your new song, think about the origins of life, the creation of things, and how God has been intimately involved in that. That his word is actually something that you can trust, and that what he is, and you can see that in the creation of the heavens and the earth. Side note, because I like to harp on this later in other contexts. Notice that it says, by the breath of his mouth, all their host. That's the same word for the Spirit of God. You got the Word of God and the Spirit of God side by side there. It's just a pet peeve with me. You can ignore it if you want. Anyway, the second reason is, at the second part of verse 4, and all his work is done in faithfulness. Jump down to verse 7. He explains it. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deeps in storehouses. God, the way that God works, the way that he is in control over creation and providence, is that even when you think about all the waters of the earth, whether it's a creek or a stream or a puddle or an ocean, he is able to gather them up in a jar. This is how he does his work. He's faithful to keep them back. We are on dry land because for some reason, and you can explain it however you want to, but the ultimate reason is God keeps the waters back. He is able to control all these things because the way that he deals with his creation, the way that he deals with people, is in faithfulness. So you could sing a new song talking about God's faithfulness. You could sing a new song talking about God's work as he is and his word being upright. Or you could talk about this. Verse 5. He loves righteousness and justice. That gets explained in verses 8 and 9. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. You don't have to question his righteousness or his justice, because that's the stuff that he loves. That's the stuff that he lives for. This is the stuff that he metes out to his people. You can see it taking place in the history of humanity. And therefore, all the peoples, believer and unbeliever alike, ought to sing a song about justice and righteousness, because you get mad when things aren't right, and you should. But the reason you get mad that they're not right is because God established
justice, and righteousness. So sing a song about that. Then lastly, he says this at the end of verse 5. The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. Now he explains that in verses 10 through 12. He goes, the Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, and the plans of his heart to all generations. Now, the reason that's explaining his steadfast love is because he says that his counsel stands forever. And it's standing in front of me and you. Now, in order to stand in front of somebody in this context, in an ancient Near Eastern context, you have to say, if I stand in front of you, what I'm saying is, you have honor. And therefore, I'm going to stand, my counsel is going to stand in front of you because I am pouring and heaping honor upon you. I want you to think about that, that God is saying that you're not standing in front of him, honoring him. He's standing in front of you, honoring you. That's why his steadfast love fills the earth. That's why his love for you fills the earth. But he goes even further than that in verse 12. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen as his heritage. I've been dealing a lot with inheritance type stuff lately. You don't get to choose your inheritance. Your inheritance chooses you, right? And so you have to take whatever is coming to you. But what God says is he looks out and he goes, I choose you as my inheritance. I choose you as the one that I want to be with as my possession forever. So I'm going to stand before you and honor you. I'm going to choose you to be in relationship with you forever. This is the explanation of his steadfast love. And so he says, if you need a new song, and I want you to sing a new song, so I want you to obey my command, and you need some new material, here it is. Here is the character of God, one whose word is upright, whose work is done in faithfulness, who loves righteousness and justice, and who has his steadfast love meted out to us by honoring us and choosing us as his heritage. He goes further. The psalmist goes further. The actions of the Lord. You find there starting in verse 13. He goes, look, the Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of man. From where he sits enthroned, he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. What the psalmist is saying is that he's attentive. He's looking down, not like when God looked down on the Tower of Babel saying, boy, that thing is so small, I got to get down here to actually even see it. He's saying, no, he's looking down because he is attentive. He's aware of who we are and that he wants to be actively involved in our lives. His vision, the psalmist says, is also there in verse 14. From where he sits enthroned, he looks out. And what he's saying is, basically, God is in charge. He's sitting in the midst of his sovereignty, and in the midst of that, he's noticing us. It'd be if I actually tweeted, which I don't. I'm not even sure how. But let's say I did, and I was on my phone, and I said, I saw Matt Odom on the square today. Right? You would be like, eh, that's not that big a deal. However, if LeBron James tweeted, I just saw Matt Odom. White boys got bunnies. Tweet. Oh, my. The king. The king just acknowledged my presence. He saw me from his throne and he said, I've got hops. That makes a big deal. That makes a splash. So when the psalmist says, from his throne, he looks down on us. That's a big deal. It says that he fashions the hearts of them all. And that's kind of the language of the sculptor. He's squeezing the mud of us. He's got his hands are getting dirty. He's involved in our lives so much so that he understands how our hearts work. He understands the wants and the needs because he was the creator of them. So when you want things and you need things, he knows that because that's how he made you. It continues. It says, he who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. This is, once again, more of a scientific observation, meaning that he looks at everything that we're doing, believer and unbeliever alike. Again, this is a kind of a universal psalm. It has different applications, but he's saying this applies to everybody. He's seeing, he's interested, he's intimately involved, not only in our wants and our needs, but also in the stuff that we're doing. And that can either make you very uncomfortable, or that can make you give you a sense of comfort and contentment that God understands what's taking place in my life. All right, fifthly, the psalmist talks about the protection of God in verse. Oh no, I must have missed something. Did we miss false hopes? Yeah, well, all right, my bad. All right, let's talk about false hopes there in verses 16 and 17. He goes, the king is not saved by his great army, and a warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might, it cannot rescue. The psalmist steps back from his talk about who God is and his commands in our lives and goes, look, here is the recipe that a lot of people have chosen to employ in their lives. They go after having the great army, the great strength, the war horse, the great might. But none of that stuff ends up delivering because a lot of kings with great armies and a lot of kings with great strength and a lot of nations with wonderful war horses ended up being destroyed. Case in point, in Israel's history, take Egypt. Israel, go back to verse 9. I mean, there could be allusions here to Israel is fleeing from Egypt. They're following the pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And they come up to the Red Sea and they're like, oh, no, it's over with. Egypt is bearing down on them. God takes the seas. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap, and he puts the deeps in the storehouses. Or verse 9, for he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. Boom. Waters stand firm. And they make it through. They're saved. They're delivered. They're rescued. But then he cuts loose. And the army, the great army of Egypt, who had many, many war horses, and they had lots of strength, all becomes naught. Because God lets loose the water that was in the storehouses. He commands and it shuts down. He says, so if you want to go that way, know that there is a history of finding hope in things other than God. He's just laying that out for it. He says, but if you're afraid, because that's understandable, look at the protection that God has provided for you there in verse 18 and 19. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him and on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Literally, his eye is smack dab on you. That he's so close that he understands exactly what's going. And so if there's going to be something that goes that is attacking you, whether it's spiritual or physical, it has to go through God first. And this is language of those last moments when you are about to die. Death is imminent. You can't escape it. It's going to happen. And he goes, if that's the case, your soul will be delivered. And the word there that he uses for being alive in famine is resurrection language. You will be raised out of that which has caused you to die. Because resurrection is the ultimate in protection. Because it too completely depends upon the steadfast love of the Lord. When he says he's chosen us as his heritage, when it says that he is standing before us and honoring us, the ultimate display of that is in the person and work of Jesus. when he said, this is what I will do for you. I will die for you. I will live for you. I will die for you. I will raise again for you. Now, you might show up to worship, or let's just use worship as a metaphor for your life. And you might just be mouthing the words. You're back there lip syncing. All right? You're going through the motions. You show up and you're cynical, or you're bored, and you're like, resurrection, Jesus died, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Heard it all before. I would ask you, just as do it as a favor to me, to take a few moments, a day maybe, and reflect upon your mortality. And think, what are my options really? If I sit down with myself by myself and just think, what are my options? You've got a few. You've got that you become worm food in the event that you die or when you die. Or you're raised to life. Or there's eternal death and punishment. Or there's reincarnation or some variation thereof. All right? Now, I want you to consider the commands that were at the beginning of the psalm in light of any other option but resurrection. Shout for joy. Play skillfully. Sing a new song. All of these things. Because in light of any other option other than resurrection, those commands are ludicrous. Why would I shout for joy if I'm just going to be worm food? I can shout for joy for a little bit, I guess. I can live for the moment. There's a great op-ed in the New York Times this week. Drawing a blank on the guy's name. Oliver Sacks, is that a name? Is that a real name? Okay. And he's talking about his life, and he's been diagnosed with, he has cancer, and it's metastasized, and he's going to die soon. I'm just going to live for me. I'm going to do it all for me. He's a neurologist, right? Yeah, Awakenings. That was the guy. So that guy. And he's saying he's going to do it all for him. For him, the option of resurrection is ludicrous. And he goes, so all I've got is I'll just live my life to the fullest, and then at the end, it's the end. Or if you've got these other options of reincarnation or something like that, you go, well, I've got to be really good or I come back as a cockroach. Or I've got to be really good or I come back in this way. Or my cycle keeps going this and this and this. This becomes ludicrous. At what point does it stop? Somewhere in your life you're following commands. Somebody is commanding you. Some worldview is saying, this is how we want you to do. You either shout for joy or you shout for cynicism. Or you shout with pain or you shout with angst. Whatever it is. This is what we want you to do, and you follow that command. Everybody is following a command somewhere. So you need to figure out, as you reflect on your mortality, what are the commands that I'm following? And do those commands promise life, either here and now or later? And what's the cost? Because the cost for the commands that are here is that God says, I will honor you, and I will choose you as my heritage. I will bear the cost so that you can have life. I will bear the cost so that you can shout for joy, so that you can play skillfully, so that you can sing a new song. My steadfast love will endure forever so that you can have all these things. Something you might want to think about. All right, last thing. The prayer of the Lord's people is verses 20 through 22. And this is a corporate prayer. He goes, our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield, for our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us even as we hope in you. Our soul waits for the Lord. Who is it that can wait? Have you ever thought about that? Who's good at waiting? Do you know anybody that's good at waiting? I mean, I've known some people. The people that are good at waiting are those that are confident that waiting will not harm them or their cause, whatever they end up doing.
They're like, I can wait because I'm confident in who I'm waiting upon, or I'm confident in the cause that I'm waiting for. And when it happens, then that will be the exact right time that it was supposed to happen. How? How can they do that? It's because of that second part of that verse, because he is our help and our shield. I trust in who God is. I trust in the person I'm waiting upon. Therefore, I can go ahead and wait. I've got stuff taking place in my life. You're saying, I've got pain. I've got sorrow. I've got questions. I've got confusion. I've got real fear about whether it's my health or my financial well-being or my emotional status or whatever it is. And you go, well, our prayer is that we're going to wait upon him, that he's our help and our shield. And it's interesting how the prayer progresses. He goes, our heart is glad in him. We trust in his holy name. He keeps giving us reasons to wait, why we should wait. See, Christianity is a waiting religion. It's a waiting way of life. This doesn't mean that you're inactive. It doesn't mean that you're passive. But it means that you live by faith. You can't avoid it. You have to wait for God to bless you. You have to wait for God to restore you. You have to wait for resurrection. You have to wait for deliverance. You have to wait for retribution. Wait for healing and affirmation. And he says, in the midst of this waiting, you can trust in the Lord because of all the things that he said previously about himself. But here is the greatest part of this prayer for me, because I'm horrible at waiting. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. Meaning, I'm not very good at waiting. I'm hoping in you. I'm trusting in you. But I still need your steadfast love to envelop me, because I'm not really good at this. My faith is weak. So I need you to settle your love on top of me. I need you to meet me even before I expect it. You're sitting there waiting and you're like, this is going to take, you know, when you sit at the train tracks and you can't see the caboose, and you're thinking, oh man, I'm here forever. And your prayer is, God, it looks like I'm going to be here forever. I really need you to to meet me before I expect it. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. Even. We're seeing it down here, but I would love for you to meet me right here. That is a wonderful, wonderful prayer for us. So this is what David lays before us. This is what helps us as we come to this table, as we wait to enjoy the wedding feast of the Lamb in the new heavens and the new earth, where we will sing new songs and play skillfully as ever. But right now, let's say the corporate prayer of response. You'll find it there on page 7, and then we will come to the table. So pray with me.